All right. Art of Darkness, After Dark, Rod Serling. Brad, that was a hoot.
All right, good, man. Yeah, it was fun.
What an American life, right?
That was something I wanted to kind of get to come out. Was like, this is, there's something quintessentially American about this fella.
Yeah, really. Yeah. Even the chain smoking.
Yeah. Right down to that. Even the advertising. Honestly, I mean, you go and you fight in World War II and you come back and you make your fortune and you work hard and you know you get married, you have kids, and
upstate New York, Connecticut, Ohio, New York City. You move to LA. You're doing your thing, and you make this cultural product which has had untold impact. Mm-hmm. That entire generation of people who grew up watching The Twilight Zone then went on and made their own material.
I think anybody writing sci-fi for television, maybe not as much now, but certainly 90s to early 2000s, anybody who was writing sci-fi for TV was probably somewhat versed in Twilight Zone.
I think without a doubt. I remember going to the Austin Film Festival and hearing Carter. Is it Aaron Carter who created
Chris Carter?
Chris Carter. Well, yeah. I don't know. Chris Carter, who created the X-Files.
Yeah.
The big story he told was that he, in part to put himself through college, he did production pottery in the summers, and he would watch old episodes of classic television while he was doing the production pottery. And so he internalized all these things, but he says it was also the fact that they were on in the background and he was using his hands. He thinks he rewired his brain to have television brain, the way that Rod Serling had television brain.
And so that's fascinating.
This sort of high strangeness in American culture. Mm-hmm. Nothing has ever really outdone the Twilight Zone for that.
Well, and there was something, I mean, it gets kind of lumped into science fiction, and I suppose it is, but like, I think up until the Twilight Zone, at least in TV and films, maybe not so much, you know, there was probably some weirder, more experimental stuff happening on the page, but, you know, you had something like Buck Rogers, which, not even necessarily taking anything away from that, but it was fundamentally just like an action adventure. And instead of skeleton monsters, it was aliens. You know, it was this format and the shape of the stories was all the same. And then Rod Serling kind of comes along and he puts this thing into the imagination that's like, it's some of it's sci-fi. Sure, there's going to be aliens, but you know, there's very little like action. There's no, people aren't like fighting. There's no, it's drama more than
would
it is.
Would you define it as kind of a middle brow product?
Oh, I think so. Or is
it, it's not really low brow.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, kind of a, okay. Yeah.
Especially when you compare it to what else was on television at the time.
So you know, there's a level of sophistication here.
Yeah. And they're playing with ideas.
There's a monster in the town, and it's a six-year-old boy, and everyone has to smile. I mean, it's like, whoa. There's an elevated quality to that that's really creepy.
It's smart. And even, if it's not highbrow, it's maybe, you know, I guess you could come up with a definition of art in which Twilight Zone doesn't even belong, maybe. But I don't know. I think it is, but yeah, it's it was, you know, interesting diving in too, because I really didn't know anything about him. I didn't realize how much of it he wrote, to be honest. I knew he had written some.
I gotta say it one more time, man. Bulk of the series, dude. What does he say? He's like no lightweight or real heavyweight or something.
Something like that.
Branded. Yeah. I just have to say, sir. Yeah. The first branded, especially the first two seasons, something like that.
Yeah. It was really deep inspiration to me. Right. He asks, Walter asks his wife, I think it's his wife, the woman who's there, Pilar, he asks her, does he still write?
That's like their housekeeper or their nurse.
He's in the iron lung thing. And she goes, no, he has health problems.
And then Sobchak is like, oh, I see. Right. Yeah. And a good day to you, sir.
That's right.
It's such a weird aside, and it's such a good movie.
It really is.
And then the dude, this is whatever, this is the Patreon, but the dude, he's drinking his, he gets roofied at the yeah. porn, the pornographer's house, and then he's yeah. like, what's the song? And then they say he ran away.
Yeah.
Brendan!
Brendan!
It's such a strange little pull, you know.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
yeah, 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 yeah.
No, you. When we were watching that, I kind of realized that, like, everything that almost I haven't quite articulated this. Most of the stuff that the dude says, everything that happens in his dreams, and most of the stuff that he says is actually something that came up earlier. It's something somebody else said, or something he saw, or something he. And when it's not, he's like angry and yelling.
Basically. Yeah.
Yeah. There's something weird about that.
Yeah.
You mean coitus? Like
you just like, well, but that jives with my thesis that Lebowski is about the end of the American masculine identity coming up to the end of the West.
Sure.
So he's a purely reactionary, reactive character,
yeah.
which is a very interesting idea for a protagonist. But we digress from Rod Serling. But there is that kind of funny quality where like something like Lebowski is so steeped in the existing cultural product that the existing cultural product almost disappears. It's like it's so referential that it becomes its own unique thing.
Yeah,
and Serling was doing the same thing, right? I mean, I'm sure he was riffing on Lovecraft and, you know, as you mentioned, these other sort of classic science fiction, speculative fiction.
Yeah. It's interesting when he was starting the Twilight Zone, like when it had been accepted, but they hadn't produced any yet, you know, he went to Ray Bradbury, who he kind of knew. And he said, Ray, I don't know anything about science fiction. Like, you gotta help me. And Ray Bradbury just gave him a stack of books, and he was like, "Read these, and you know, let me know if you got questions." Basically, and then Serling ended up hiring the writers of most of the books Ray Bradbury handed him as writers. One of whom was Richard Matheson, who wrote what was that Will Smith zombie movie?
Remember? Oh, the Will Smith zombie movie. Yeah, oh, like, was it I Am Legend?
I Am Legend. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Richard Matheson wrote I Am Legend. And he also wrote a number of, probably the second highest number of Twilight Zone episodes. So, yeah, I kind of, man, I realized, you know, when I was a kid, I had assumed that I had seen all of the Twilight Zones, but man, there are a lot.
How many episodes were there?
I think there's 156.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
Man, it is a different time. I mean, and did he also produce them? So he was involved in he owned it. I mean, this guy was an auteur. I mean, he had his thing and he went at it and he hammered at it.
Yeah, he really did. Yeah. He was going for it, and it worked more or less. I mean, you know, a show being on for 6 years is, that's hard to pull off.
Yeah.
And especially when you're doing something that's unusual to have it go for that long. I mean, you know, you can get stuff to last 6 years now, but like 6 years, honestly, six seasons for most shows is too many.
A lot of shows jumped the shark.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
I think that this had the format of the anthology show where, you know, they could do a new thing every time.
Yeah,
you had the general structure of it. So I could see something like that.
Yeah, that could last longer.
This is a different world, too, where the short story still had, I think, a little more prestige at the time. And so the anthology series in television is kind of the equivalent of a bunch of short stories connected by a conceptual arc.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas now, of course, it's all with some notable exceptions. I mean, it's all long form. We're going to follow Tony Soprano for six seasons and then leave you hanging at the end and create this masterpiece of a character study.
Which is also amazing. There's just that, you know, it highlights the fact that there's sort of different modes. Well, then you have the sitcom, which, you know, most of them aren't very good, but it's somewhere in the between. It's recurring characters, but, you know, what happened in the previous episode only has kind of minimal bearing on what's going on in the current episode.
Well, in a funny way, there is nothing more Beckettian than the sitcom.
Right.
Seinfeld is extremely Beckettian. Oh, yes. Where we're just back again.
Right. Right,
we're
right.
just waiting for Godot again in the living room.
Right. Right. Yeah. Show about nothing. And all of a sudden we're 40 and
Yep. I guess Jerry does comedy on the road and
apparently. Yeah.
Wacky things happen and we're back again.
That was one thing that was funny about that show. It was like so he was a comedian who was making a living at it, but like his career in the show of Seinfeld, the character of Seinfeld, his career has no ups and downs to it. It just hums along at a constant, fine enough to pay for this apartment.
Yep.
But nothing, it's
the women don't really get better looking. The environment doesn't get better looking. It's not like he starts wearing bling or anything. It's very hamster wheel, New York City. Mm-hmm. But that's the format for sitcoms too.
Sure.
Nothing, Jerry. Nothing. And it's like you either get it or you don't. There's no middle ground. Oh, I like Seinfeld, or oh, I like it well enough. It's like no, you either.
Every 6 months, I end up. I don't really watch episodes anymore, but. Every 6 months or so, I just go on YouTube and watch like whatever clip compilations people have put together.
I went through and binged the whole thing at one point, and every single minute of it is to me just a complete joy. I think it's just beyond funny.
Oh, it's absolutely brilliant.
Big fan. Big fan. For sure. Well, so so in researching Rod Serling, how did you go about it? Did you principally work with the book or did you, how many episodes did you go back and watch?
I probably watched 12 or 15 episodes plus patterns, plus one or two other non-Twilight Zone things that he'd shown. I tried to watch The Night Gallery and it's really hard to get my hands on for some reason. Like I literally ended up not watching any of it.
Because you couldn't find it?
Yeah, it only streams on like Paramount or something weird. So
I wonder, you know, if you had been, I mean, it's fine obviously, but I wonder if you had been able to find them from a library or something on DVD.
Yeah, I should have probably tried to do that. That would have
been maybe. Yeah, but, no, that's all right though. I had heard about The Night Gallery. I'd heard about that.
And I heard it wasn't really that good. So, you know, maybe it didn't really matter, but yeah. So I read that. I read the Rod Serling biography and I watched a number of episodes of Twilight Zone and other stuff. And then there's also a lot of just interviews and talks that Serling gave. And so I listened to several hours of those, just mostly trying to get his vibe.
Go ahead, finish your thought.
Yeah, no, I found him to be extremely likable. Like, and there's a compilation of him talking about writing, and I found that actually to be some pretty dang good writing advice, actually. So there's some good stuff out there.
You know, interesting. I didn't know this, but the pilot episode of The Night Gallery was the debut of Spielberg.
Oh, yeah. I actually had that in my notes. Yeah, and it was an episode that Spielberg really didn't like. He didn't want to work on it.
Hey.
But the producer had somehow, Spielberg's probably another guy who also could back it up, but talked his way into some stuff because he got promised, he was like 20 or something, and he was promised by the producer of Night Gallery that he could direct an episode. It was an episode about a woman who, she was blind and she could take the eyes of somebody else but she would only be able to see for a few hours, but then the other person would no longer be able to see, I think. And then she did it what was weird is they did it. They gave her the new eyes at night and then she walked out into the street and she thought she was still blind. She got hit by a car. Like the plot didn't even make any sense. It's like, why weren't the headlights on? Like, it's none of it. Like, that haven't made any sense.
We're in the Twilight Zone.
We're in the Twilight
Zone. Call it the Night Gallery. It's still the Twilight Zone.
Yeah, it's the same thing.
Yeah, that's fun, man.
So this biography was good. I also listened to a number of interviews with Serling's daughter, Anne, who had written a biography of him as well that focused more on the kind of family side of things. So it was good. It was, you know. These episodes are getting fun to do. I mean, there are some work admittedly, but man, I feel like I learn a lot. And
you mentioned, I didn't really jump in on this during the episode. I maybe should have, but that angry young man thing is very much tied into the British movement of playwrights.
Is it?
Yeah, there's a play famously called Look Back in Anger.
Okay.
That premiered at the Royal Court Theater, John Osborne, and that 56, that spurred, that play spawned the term angry young men, for Osborne and those of his, generation who employed realism. I'm reading right now, in contrast to more escapist theater and Look Back in Anger. If you're not familiar with it, you're going to want to be, you can find, there's a film version of it. That's solid. It created, it was one of the first examples of the kitchen sink drama.
Okay.
So you're, you know, instead of setting a play at a palatial estate in the country, we're going to do this in a working class kitchen.
Interesting.
That's
I bet Serling was aware of that, honestly, because he was always kind of around the edges of theater. He was interested in it, and you know, wanted to be a player.
This is back when theater had relevance wasn't completely whatever it is now. Just sort of considered to be this almost like sideshow in the culture. I mean, this is back when it was really, really central to the culture.
Sure.
It still is to a certain degree. We'd like to believe in the theater.
It would be interesting. It'd be interesting to know what would it take for there to be like a somewhat of a comeback.
Yeah, I mean, Americans love musicals. I mean, you have obviously Hamilton was a big moment, and it had an effect on the culture. Yeah. So it's always sort of there, partly because New York is so central to American culture. And there are moments; it has its moments. Certainly, it'd be fun to see the great American play really make a comeback and cross over into the mainstream without having to break in song. Right, you know, it'd be nice if we could just have a riveting straight play that knocks everybody out. But I mean, it's going to be interesting to see, because the theater forces you to be in the room with other people. And after this pandemic, people are going to hopefully want more of that.
I hope the response is that people want to be in spaces together and not like, well, what, you know, it wasn't so bad, so maybe I won't. Like, you know,
right.
Get outside.
I think Rod Serling is our first example of somebody who like didn't quite do what he wanted to do. That's interesting to me.
Yeah.
Are you convinced about that he had regrets?
There's stuff you can I mean, there's all kinds of stuff in this biography about moments that he said that and called himself a hack, and he said that, you know, he was never, apparently was never going to be able to do the thing he wanted to do, and try to get Requiem for a Heavyweight produced as a play, and it did, but it kind of sucked and everybody kind of knew it, you know, and like he thought being in the theater would be established, and he got like this long bitter review about how terrible it was in the Los Angeles Times. And you know, he would go on TV and interviews and, you know, claim he was happy about everything, and some people said he was, and some people, you know, he was like anybody, he probably had good days and bad days, but I don't think he was like a depressed mess or anything, but he wanted to be thought of as a writer. You know, you look up to Arthur Miller and Ernest Hemingway, and then it's hard to.
There's a sign dedicated to him in Binghamton. I want to get an idea of where this is on the map. Sure. But it says, in honor of Rod Serling, class of 43, creator of Twilight Zone, award-winning dramatist, playwright, and lecturer.
He lectured at Ithaca College mostly. Yeah, a little bit at Antioch as well. There's a museum there in Binghamton I always meant to go to when I lived in that part of the country, and I never did. But there's people around there. It's funny. Well, this is true of anybody who's sort of famous, but like there's people around him who have like stories of people who have stories of him, you know, like down in that southern. Because I spent a bit of time down in Elmira, that southern part of New York, and his legend lives on for sure.
Yeah, that is really cool. Yeah, Binghamton, that's kind of in this weird no man's land, kind of west, central west, kind of on the border with Pennsylvania. I'd love to visit that part of the world. Yeah. I see Endicott out there. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, if you go just a little bit further to the west and you go to Elmira, you can go to Mark Twain's grave.
Ah, I didn't know that Mark Twain was buried there.
Yeah, it's kind of bizarre. I was there with a girl that I was dating who's from down there, and she's like, what did she say? She sort of like either she didn't tell me at first or I didn't believe her. She was like, do you want to go see Mark Twain's grave? And I was like, in my head, I was like, why would Mark Twain be buried in Elmira, New York? Like, that doesn't make any sense.
Right. Well, we visited his house in Hartford, Connecticut. That was quite fun.
Okay.
That's a good visit if you're ever in Connecticut.
Yeah, for sure.
To see how Mark Twain lived.
That'd be an interesting episode one day down the line.
A gimme. Yeah, I think you should do that one.
Yeah,
for
I
sure.
would. I wrote a very detailed paper on him.
Interesting American character.
There's some darkness at the end too.
He was bitter and kind of the first stand-up comedian, or one of the first stand-ups. Yeah, this is fun. I'm looking at a picture of Serling chomping on a cigar sitting there. Yeah. Serling at home in 1959 with three of his Emmys on the cabinet behind him.
Now look at a Serling in 1975 or Night Gallery cover.
Yeah, let me look it up. Rod Serling.
A little ghoulish.
Really? Just starts to get that like Hollywood look.
Yeah, it's like tan.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I see what you're saying. He starts to look like somebody who's kind of pickled himself a little
bit. I think he did. Yeah, I think maybe it's possible this biography was going a little easy on, you know, who knows. When you don't have that much. There's only two biographies. One's written by a fan of him and one's written by his daughter.
Sure.
Like,
yeah.
How much dirt are you really going to be able to get?
Yeah. So, you got to take it all kind of in context. Well, look, this is very cool. I think this is a fun pick. I think it's a great example of somebody who made a huge impact, but then proceeded to call himself a hack and wasn't totally satisfied with his contribution. It would be amazing if you could bring him into the present and show him the past 20 years of television.
He would be so excited. In so many of these talks and these conversations, he's sort of disparaging like crappy TV.
Yeah.
Like he wanted it to be so, 2001 Space Odyssey came out and he loved it.
Oh, really?
Right. So, like, he knew that TV wasn't quite there yet.
Right.
You know, so.
Well, it was an artistic ghetto for a long time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And obviously now it isn't anymore. Yeah. Brad, this was great, man. I really enjoyed it. And I hope if you're listening to this, you enjoyed it as well. And I'm going to probably begin my research into good old Tennessee here soon.
Oh, man.
And
Cat on a Hat Tin Roof is like literally like, maybe not a top 10 movie, but it's one of my, honestly it is. I would, it's great.
Glass Menagerie, Streetcar. What's better than Streetcar? Nothing's better than Streetcar. And Tennessee is one of these guys who just, his life spanned the century, and he did it the right way, and he was troubled and amazing. And I think that's a gimme subject for this troubled playwright.
yeah, for sure.
All right, my man. All right. This is Art of Darkness, artofdarkpod.com. I hope everybody enjoys the Mayweather-Logan Paul circus fight.
Is that tonight?
It's tonight, and I am I'm streaming it right over here. I'm streaming but it's a French streaming service, and anytime I click on anything, I get ads for things that are completely inappropriate. And it's, my computer probably has a virus. I'm probably going to have all of my AMC stock is going to be dumped from my account tomorrow.
To
the
moon,
baby! Apes hodl! We hodl! All right, man.
All right.
Talk to you later.
Peace. Bye.